Welcome to this week's edition of The Dark State. I am joined by Ciarán O'Connor from the Institute for Strategic Dialogue in London. We are about to discuss the violent riots that took place in Dublin on Thursday and the rise of the far right across Ireland.
This programme has been recorded on the morning after Dublin City Central, parts of it certainly were set on fire and looted. Following a series of radical calls for action by elements of the far right. So, Ciarán, there's a very complex issue, there's a lot happening, and it's a fast-moving story. But you and I were certainly talking last night, and we both kept an eye on what was happening online and the contribution that far-right actors were making in terms of instigating violence and instigating this activity. It should also be stated that Ciarán published a report earlier on this week on the role that the far right is playing in Ireland and how it was actually growing. So, Ciarán, what I'm going to ask you to do is talk me through your report, and then we're going to talk about what actually happened in Dublin and the consequences of that. And what we're really seeing is the physical manifestation now of various viewpoints and ideologies. We're actually seeing that now in the real world and in a quite serious and significant way. So, Ciarán, can you, just to begin, take me through your report and what you found? Because this is all turning out to be very timely now.
Sure, yeah. So, the research that we've published recently is called Ishkafui Talov, an online investigation into online mis- and disinformation ecosystem in Ireland. The analysis draws on over 13 million posts published across 12 online social media platforms between the beginning of 2020 and up to April of this year, 2023. It's the result of a 9-month research project undertaken by my colleagues and myself and I, and our research analyzed mis- and disinformation in Ireland with a specific focus on actors, topics and platforms involved in extensive detail. And the result is, we believe, one of the most comprehensive studies by the Irish mis- and disinformation landscape or ecosystem to date. And just on that term ecosystem, just so it's kind of clear what we're referring to, this ecosystem is made up of actors, so prominent public figures, groups, organizations, and the online accounts attributed to them, and these actors and accounts having a clear history of having previously shared false or misleading information or conspiracy theories or having had used hateful mis- or disinformation narratives to describe or target particular groups. So the research is broken down into three reports. The first is just a summary report, but the kind of setting the scene aspects has a methodology, all of that kind of thing. And then the second and third report are a platforms report, looking at how platforms have been used by these kinds of communities in the ecosystem. And the third report is looking at topics. So what kind of topics were actors in this ecosystem discussing? So the main three were health, which includes a lot of COVID and discussion about COVID, then followed by Irish politics and discussion about Irish politicians and politics in this country, and also immigration. So they're the top three targets. There's other topics. There's other topics like climate, LGBTQ issues, and general global conspiracy theories, and so on.
So what did you find? It's a very complicated picture and there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of components to it. What did you find? Because it is quite startling.
Yeah, there's three main findings with this report. So in a general sense, first of all, I think we've all become aware in this country over the last few years that online platforms are being used to create and share false, misleading, and potentially harmful claims and content. I think what this research does is provide evidence to support that statement that shows that since 2020, the online ecosystem that is active in producing and promoting mis- and disinformation in Ireland online is growing. The second finding, kind of leading on from that, is that the research project provides evidence that links across various topics how online discussions containing mis- and disinformation are fueling offline hostility and violence. And the third major finding being that all of this kind of online dynamic of this is that social media platforms are not enforcing their own community guidelines. Across the course of this study and across different topic areas, we identified numerous examples of content that appears to be in clear violation of the platform in question's community guidelines, and posts that may have a fact-checking label attached to them still receiving widespread attention or traction on social media platforms. So those are the three main findings, and they're kind of brought into sharp focus, I suppose, over the events in Dublin of the last 24 hours. And I suppose just one of the last another finding really was that the activity that the far right groups and individuals are drivers of mis- and disinformation. So across the majority of topics, what we found was that the most prolific and most popular actors within this ecosystem were often figures with a history of advocating for far right ideologies on and offline. And these figures play a crucial role in producing and promoting false, misleading, and potentially harmful claims across this this ecosystem we studied.
And Kieran, before we move on, when you say creating false narratives, etc., can you give me some examples of that? What type of information are we talking about? You and I know what it is, but maybe to the listeners, they'd have a great interest in hearing your views.
Sure, yeah. I think it's helpful to use an example here. So if we consider the topic of immigration, so obviously over the last 12 months, there's been a significant surge in, anti-immigration protests in the country. What this study, what this research project was not focused on, was not interested in, was, local communities who perhaps are organizing protests based on the availability of resources in a center, being able to house asylum seekers, these kinds of things. Genuine kind of local concerns as they're described. What this research project was focused on was how this topic was being exploited and how social media was being weaponized to promote topics related to, so again, looking at immigration, we've become familiar with the term military-aged males, or we've heard a lot about how the influx of asylum seekers into Ireland in the last 12 plus months represents supposedly a new plantation. So, and that being an existential threat to the Irish people, those kinds of claims. So using these different topics, be it health, be it Irish politics, or be it immigration, as the basis for which to share false or misleading claims that often are used to target other communities, often minority communities. So essentially using the basis of this topic to produce and promote false and misleading claims related to that topic.
Yeah, it's really interesting because this is an area that usually when it's documented, certainly as a journalist, when I write about these things, there is a certain cohort of people, including many people in my own profession, who immediately assume this is all being exaggerated and overstated and it's just activity that happens online. I don't know whether you've come across this view yourself, but very few people actually recognize this. They might do now, but in the past, very few people have recognized the dangers, the inherent dangers in allowing people to circulate false information freely without any consequence to themselves.
Yeah, and I think what we've tried to do in our analysis or research up to date, and certainly in this research project, is provide evidence that shows how the kind of blurring of the on and offline worlds now, and especially as it relates to discussions that are taking place online featuring false or misleading and very serious claims about migrants, for example, and how that is having a very clear impact offline. So not even just related to immigration, but if you think about the kinds of online discussions that were taking place in 2020 promoting anti-lockdown or anti-vaccine protests based on false or misleading or exaggerated or inflammatory claims, but also, of course, the anti-immigration mobilization over the past 12 months, or even separate topic maybe, but a lot of the same figures involved, the encouragement and organization of demonstrations outside libraries or bookshops or schools that target the LGBTQ community based on based on false and misleading and harmful claims about members of the LGBTQ community as well. So try to make that very clear. And the report has in the topics report three, it has lots of case studies that try and really lay out that in even like a timeline fashion of discussions on, let's say, a Monday, we're involving these kinds of claims and these kinds of calls to action, and then events playing out online and offline in the days later. And the immigration topic within the third report in particular has a case study related to Finglas. So in late January, there was a false claim that blamed, I suppose, a migrant for committing a sexual assault. And the case study in the report, that instance, just goes into extensive detail, I think, on how these discussions were taking place online. Here's where they kind of appeared, first of all, and then here's how people were kind of called to action to protest on the streets or protest outside Garda stations in that instance. So, yeah, I hope that that's kind of reflected clearly in the report, because the online and the offline are no longer kind of distinct domains, I guess. They're, what we're seeing happening online is having clear impact offline.
Exactly. And if my memory serves me correct, when that particular rumor was circulated, quite deliberately in my view, Garda headquarters actually came out and issued statements to say that it wasn't true and they were looking for a different suspect, or they were investigating a different type of allegation entirely. And I think there was a recognition that this had become so problematic and was leading to all sorts of rumours within the community. It was causing chaos in terms of social cohesion in that area.
Yes, and in quite, I suppose, unprecedented fashion, what we've seen Gardaí have to do over the past 12 months is issue statements that say and make very clear there is misinformation circulating in relation to an incident or a case or whatever it might be, as a sort of, I suppose, a kind of a warning or a flag for the public to be careful in how discussions about this are taking place. And I don't think we've seen that before, but in particular, in relation to claims of related to immigration, these kinds of things, we have seen that, because the if you think about a false or a harmful claim that's posted online and it gets shared rapidly across one platform, but then across many different platforms, and it then might lead someone else to issue a call to action on the base of that claim. The time it takes for a tweet, let's say, to be posted, it takes 10 times as long for either a journalist to go and do their job, or maybe the Gardaí to investigate, or a fact check to be researched and published. So there's a very, I suppose, fluid or kind of dynamic that is helping and assisting in the spread of very harmful and inflammatory claims that can lead to, you know, very real world harm and violence as well.
And Kieran, before we move on again, because this question just popped into my mind, social media companies and tech companies, they're not even abiding by their own, what many would describe as, lax regulations. Now, there's reasons why they don't do that, because they make money from advertising, and the more extreme content that is posted, the more clicks, etc., it attracts, and the more attention it generates, because these companies are involved in the attention business, and they're trying to keep people staring at screens. But is this really part of the problem, that governments are not really tackling this at its source? And in some ways, the kind of posting of such material, the violence it causes and facilitates, that this is just the symptom of a much more deep-rooted problem. And I recently interviewed Alex Younger, who is a former chief of MI6. He was the longest serving C in that intelligence service. And he made a remark to me about, we can talk about Russian disinformation campaigns and everything else, but the real problem is these companies, they profiteer from the existence of a culture war and these issues within society. And this is something that we're ignoring at our peril.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that. And the spread of false or misleading or potentially harmful information, you know, it's not a new phenomenon. But what is new is the speed and the reach that such information can now attain as a result of, you know, advancements in technology and social media, but also the impact of online networks in helping to spread such information. And part of the challenge in researching misinformation, but in particular disinformation, is that even some of our the way we try and research it, disinformation is difficult to define. I mean, we define it as false or misleading or manipulated content presented as fact that is intended to deceive or harm. But even that is somewhat simplistic and maybe overly focused on content. There's also the issue of false identities or fake campaigns or artificial popularity that are all also used as part of a playbook for actors intent on deceiving others online. But if you think of current legislation that's kind of that has been introduced to try and tackle this issue, consider Digital Services Act, for example. That primarily focuses on how online platforms tackle illegal content. But as this research project and others illustrate, so much of mis and disinformation is what's regarded as harmful but not illegal content. So research on this remains a challenge because of that. Now the DSA will potentially transform the existing EU code of practice on disinformation into a code of conduct, which would compel the signatories, so major tech platforms and online advertiser organizations, to commit to the demonetization of mis and disinformation, but also transparency of political advertising, ensuring the empowerment of fact checkers and research. And then also locally, we have the Online Safety and Media Regulation Act. Now, that doesn't directly address disinformation or misinformation, but it does contain provisions to add novel types of harmful content at any stage. So hopefully this research could inform, you know, potential discussions around that. But in the wider context, we've seen that social media platforms and the guidelines that are designed to curb this kind of content and this kind of activity online it's not working. They're not enforcing their own guidelines. And this research report, I think, highlights a clear and obvious enforcement gap on platforms that is allowing false, misleading or harmful content to survive, to receive engagement and potentially encourage people to take action as well. And on a kind of related note as well, for the monetization of content like this, in the research report, there's different examples of figures who perhaps they live stream on YouTube and they have donation buttons that are YouTube features, or they plug third party platforms as well, where people can kind of financially support or donate to someone who is creating content, who is out on the streets, and their live streams are replete with false, misleading or inflammatory claims about different groups or different communities and these kinds of things. So all of this is it's part of a wider issue where it's like the kind of whack-a-mole approach of platforms to remove one piece of content or one post that has been flagged is so often not enough or not effective, because we are dealing with a whole range of tools and practices that are used by, you know, these kinds of bad actors to exploit, you know, sensitive public or social issues and weaponize social media platforms and misuse them.
It's funny, I was at a conference there last week on the future of intelligence, and one of the speakers was talking about data and people's data and how it's controlled by various companies and information on their interests, etc. And he kind of made a point. He said, data used to be gold, now it's uranium. When it leaks, when it gets out there, it can cause all sorts of problems. But it now, these ecosystems are so toxic and poisonous to society that eventually we are going to have to confront that. And that brings me on to another point, because the Irish government and many other governments have really done nothing about this. And in Ireland's case, we've allowed many of these companies to be headquartered in Dublin. Mm-hmm. We were happy about their amount of employment they created, but there's been so many social consequences to their activities that it's almost like a hyper object. There's so many that most people simply can't understand it, and they can't even understand the basics because it's so widespread and penetrative into society. And I think it's also really worth noting that this particular government and others before it, should I say, have embraced many of the founders of these companies and welcomed them and met their lobbyists and everything else, kind of almost willfully, blissfully unaware of the dangers that they actually pose and their products propose to our own society. And we're seeing that on the streets of Dublin this morning.
We are, and I think it's kind of reflected in the failure to meet the challenge of how social media platforms how they're being used has changed, especially in the last recent years. What we've found, well, I think it's kind of widely regarded, but what the research, I think, evidenced is that COVID was a catalyst for the proliferation of conspiracy theories, mis and disinformation, but also for the growth and reach of online communities that are based or built upon a kind of conspiracy theory worldview. And we know from the analysis in this research report, but also many others, not just simply about Ireland, is that the way that these kinds of communities now use social media platforms, it's a petri dish for all kinds of false and misleading claims that have clearer and clearer links to offline, you know, problems, offline harms and violence and kind of discord as well. So we've seen the use of social media become, you know, inherently toxic in so many ways. And at the core of it, there are, you know, determined groups or organizations or actors who want to use, misuse and abuse social media platforms for their own agenda as well. And in the face of this, we've seen, you know, just failures really across the board in trying to meet this challenge and trying to mitigate against it when it was, I suppose, almost like a smaller issue and not as serious as and kind of contributing, let's say, to what we've seen in the last 24 hours as well, you know.
So we're going to move on to what's happened in the past 24 hours. And because much of this was organized, was amplified, and it was orchestrated on social media, could I ask you for your views on this? Like, Kieran, you've spent a lot of your working life looking at this. I send my sympathies to you having to read this stuff because I know you've done extensive deep dives into these worlds. And there are certain issues always arise with that. But can you give me your take on what happened and the role played by social media in all of this?
Sure, yeah. First of all, what happened yesterday afternoon on Parnell Street is tragic and it's deeply sad. But what happened yesterday evening was not unsurprising and quite predictable, based on how we've observed kind of online communities reacting and kind of propagating, you know, fear about rumors and hatred in the last 12 months and over the last few years as well. Within an hour or 2 hours, immediately, let's say, after the first reports of the attack spread online, there was calls to action being shared online that made clear and very definite attributions of who the suspect was and their background and these kinds of things. What we know about the calls to action for yesterday evening was that the most prominent calls to action for protests, so, you know, posts online that included a location and a time to meet, these kinds of things, they were produced and promoted by figures who have a history of promoting anti-immigrant protests over the last 12 months and have been prominent producers and promoters of false, misleading, and inflammatory claims about migrants online. Almost immediately, as I said, when the news broke, there was little known about the attack, but there has been very definitive calls to action being shared. And then what seems to have happened last night is that mixture of crowd, kind of anti-immigrant sentiment, but also kind of wider mob mentality that kind of led to the rioting and looting. And as I said yesterday, it was shocking, but unfortunately predictable if you've been paying attention to these movements, these communities online.
And were you surprised at you had this core group of far-right actors, then suddenly their numbers being bolstered by young thugs and criminals? Because many of these people that engage in all of that type of conduct last night, setting buses on fire, attacking Gardaí, really horrendous activities, they're actually known criminals. Some of them are drug dealers, some of them are car robbers, they're thieves from around different suburbs. Many of them are already known. Some of them have served prison sentences already. They're not really political extremists. They're just thugs. They're people that exist in our communities and they just ran riot. And then you have this kind of other cohort mixing in with them that just are opportunistic people from, you know, who kind of get involved in this kind of raucous behavior when the opportunity presents itself. Were you surprised at the scale of that? Because I certainly was. I mean, I'm not surprised that the far right went into operations mode once that attack happened. I was slightly taken aback by the fact that you had such large numbers of people turning up to support them and attack guards. I mean, I saw video footage of Gardaí being quite badly and seriously assaulted. That really astonished me because you don't really see that too often in this country. I mean, the guards are a community police force. They police with consent and they're generally respected by everyone in society. Even when they're wrong, people still have respect for the uniform and that's the way it should be. But were you surprised at this? Because I know, and I get a sense from Garda headquarters, they're really surprised.
I was surprised. I was surprised at how it kind of grew throughout the evening, but I wasn't surprised that people showed up around O'Connell Street in the evening because there was clear calls to action that were being shared, some more explicit than others, being shared online for people to show up for a protest. And I think that in the mix, but it's clear that from figures who are, you know, posting online or live streaming from the events that the events on O'Connell Street last night attracted and were attended and were organized to a large degree as well by figures who have that clear history of promoting anti-immigration protests over the last 12 months, but also spreading false and misleading claims about immigrants. I believe those figures from one far right party who were on the street online, they were sharing, you know, posts related to the attack, but also related to events on O'Connell Street, along with a link to join the party. So it's been clearly used as a tool for recruitment already in the immediate aftermath as well. And then, yes, as you mentioned there, it kind of became then an opportunistic moment for figures who were clearly intent on violence. And it spread very quickly. And I mean, I've seen different reports today of migrants being based in Dublin or around the country who are circulating, you know, messages saying they're being told to not go in public, or they're in fear of being attacked simply because they're, you know, a person of color or a migrant. And this is, I mean, it's unacceptable. Like, it shouldn't be allowed, and we shouldn't be kind of accepting of this kind of sentiment, breeding fear, I suppose, into society as well. And the speed at which things developed last night as well was equally surprising and shocking as well. Yeah,
it really was astonishing. I have to say, as a journalist, I was speaking on various radio shows around the world, and I have to admit, I was embarrassed. It was very difficult to articulate what was happening in Dublin and be continuously asked, is racism a big problem? Is there such social deprivation that it causes people to act like this? And all the questions that run with it. And certainly, I mean, economically, the consequences of this are almost incalculable. I mean, who on earth would come to Dublin for a weekend now?
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's also important to point out the kind of the vacuum information. Like, I kind of touched upon it there a few minutes ago, but in the immediate aftermath, there was some very serious, you know, claims of who the suspect is or potential motives and things like this. And these having a very clear impact. I mean, it's I don't know, funny or ironic or something, how the research that we put out a couple of days ago kind of preceded this, these events of the last 24 hours. But a lot of the dynamics that we researched as part of the reports kind of played out in real time, but also leading up to yesterday as well. I mean, I suppose I've mentioned the anti-immigration sentiment of the last 12 months, but we're also talking about a longer trend as well, going back to 2018-19, when there was protests in places like Rooski and Moville or Drard and Listeren Varna as well. And the pandemic might have quelled a lot of the anti-immigrant mobilization that had been forming, but it's come back in a big way in the last 12 months. And the events on O'Connell Street last night and online in the immediate aftermath of the attack yesterday are the consequence, I suppose, of 12 plus months of this online ecosystem in which very harmful and misleading or false claims have contributed towards people and contributed towards the growth of this anti-immigrant sentiment that is having dangerous impact on the streets.
Kieran, the last question before you go: what way are the far right interpreting this? Are they happy about it? Are they keeping their heads down? Do they see this as something that is a little bit embarrassing, that things went a little bit too far, even for their liking? Or do they see this as the beginning of something much greater, that this is the start of something new? Do you get any sense of what's going on?
Yeah, I don't think there's one clear answer to that, because it can be quite an amorphous movement. I think there's strands of different elements that you've touched upon there. I do think that one of the, I suppose, major or largest sentiments that I've seen anyways is a sense of almost vindication that far-right figures or groups had they felt they had been warning the public about the danger of something like this happening for a long time, and nobody was listening to them, or the media were rejecting their kind of claims. As well as that, it's been a kind of, as I touched upon there, it's been a call for recruitment off the back of this as well. And then, yes, there's also been elements I've seen who said that, you know, there's no place for violence whilst they are appearing in the middle of protests on O'Connell Street at the same time as well. So I think the next few days will be, yeah, really crucial for seeing what way they're going to, I suppose, further react to this to this event and to this period.
So you've been listening to Ciarán O'Connor from the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Ciarán, thank you so much for joining us today. I know you're probably snowed under with lots of different requests, but certainly on behalf of myself and all the listeners to the show, I do wish to thank you sincerely. So that concludes this edition of The Dark State. I'll be posting a number of briefings for our subscribers just to keep them up to speed on what is happening and how this is all unfolding. Until we talk again, do take care.